Hi, this is Bruce Belfiore, CEO of Benchmark Portal, head of the College of Call Center Excellence, and host of the monthly podcast, Call Talk. If there's one thing I know, it's what it takes for contact centers to succeed. And if you want to learn how to transform your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, increase revenue, and create scalable systems, you should be listening to the Authentic Persuasion Show with my friend, Jason Cutter.
Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show, a place where business and thought leaders come to weigh in on important sales-related topics that you can use in your sales career and life. I'm your host, Jason Cutter. My mission is to get your help in changing sales from something prospects fear to an act of service they actually seek out and appreciate. Whether you're in sales, leading sales teams, or own a business, I hope this helps you improve your selling effectiveness and you can go out into the world as an authentic persuader. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another guest episode on the Authentic Persuasion Show. So my special guest today is Bruce Belfiore. So Bruce is CEO of Benchmark Portal, which has the world's largest database of contact center performance metrics. He also heads the College of Call Center Excellence. Sounds very official, and I'm excited to talk to him about it, which provides courses to every level of contact center professional, including sales professionals. Because one of the things is, in the industry world that I am in, contact centers usually refer to customer service and support, not always sales. But Bruce has insight and perspectives into lots of sales related as well. So we're going to talk about that. Bruce also hosts the monthly podcast called Call Talk and is a frequent writer and speaker on contact center topics. Obviously, that's why he's here. He holds an MBA and a JD, both degrees from Harvard University. So he's really, really smart, and he's going to educate us on a whole bunch of stuff. Bruce, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Jason, it's good to be with you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm excited. I feel like a broken record. I say this every guest episode. Anytime anybody's listening, they probably say, you say that every single time. I think this is fun because one of the things that happens in contact centers is there's a lot of, here's how we've always done it. There's a lot of, like, this is what we do. Here's the process. We know what we're doing. Or let's just do it this way. And I'm always shocked to see how many times there's just not metrics in place. Nobody has numbers, especially if we're talking on the sales side. There's no clear, like, scoreboard at a deep level to know winning versus not winning. Obviously, for you and what you've been doing, you have tons and tons of contact center performance metrics that people have shared with you for some reason. You must obviously be very good at convincing them to share all their metrics. What are some indicators that you've seen or found that indicate a contact center, specifically a sales team, is doing well or going to do well?
Okay, sure. Yeah, the reason they share data with us is that we then are able to turn back reports showing their data side by side with industry data. And so they're curious to compare themselves with others. And that's really valuable for them, too, because at the end of the day, that helps to focus them and their team on getting better over time. So some of the things that people look at is the average handle time. How long does it take you on average to work with a customer? Also, the average cost per call. That's something that's very closely followed by people in the industry. Both for inbound customer service, where we do a lot of our work, as well as the sales side. And other things that people will look at is average speed of answer. If you have an inbound center, whether it's customer service or sales, the average speed of answer is going to be important because of the fact that you don't want people waiting for you for a long time. They may go somewhere else, particularly on the sales side. You don't want that to happen. And in fact, there are other metrics that tie into this. For instance, your abandon rate. If you have a long average speed of answer, people are not going to stay on. They're going to put the phone down and they may go to one of your competitors. So those are the kinds of metrics that we follow and that people will give us. And in return, we're able to turn them back reports that they can use in their management and try to get better and better and better.
So in those metrics, is there any kind of blanket across the board over under line, let's say in speed to answer time frame? Is there something you found where it's like over this your chances are bad, under this like the faster? Is there a line in the sand universally?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, Jason, because what we've actually found is that it depends on your industry sector. people actually have greater or lesser tolerance, greater or lesser expectations of how long they're going to have to wait, depending on the industry sector you're in. And there used to be a rule of thumb, which was 80-20. 80% of your calls should be answered within 20 seconds, okay? And the thing is, for some industries, that's too long. For instance, if you're in emergency services, you're going to want to pick up right away. On the other hand, if you're in other sectors, tech support being one, but there's a lot of others as well. If you're calling in for insurance, that kind of thing, people have an expectation they're going to have to wait a little bit longer. And they're okay with that as long as when you pick up, when you get your salesperson at one of the Blues or at one of the other insurance companies, as long as that person is able to take care of you well. And what we've been able to do is to do studies that figure out what the more or less optimal point is in terms of average speed of answer and customer satisfaction. And again, we look at abandon rate, because you don't want people abandoning. That's where they can go away. One of the things that we will help calculate too, in many cases, is what is the revenue per call? So cost per call is really important, right? But if you're in a sales position, what's the average revenue per call? And at the point where you're figuring that your abandon rate is actually costing you more in terms of lost revenue compared to what it would cost to staff up, right? Have some more people or do some other things that makes sure that you're able to handle your calls better by having better processes, et cetera, then you really are able to add a lot of value to your center.
And now you're speaking my language, because I have generally been more on the data side, right? So I'm a sales guy. And it's funny because we joked before recording and you kind of wanted to lump me in with the salespeople and the stuff that they do, which we'll bring up here in a little bit. Right. But it's interesting because my life started on the operation side more than anything, running away from sales and wanting to be on ops and then getting pulled back in. And with my kind of scientific data background in general, I like the numbers and diving in. And then also as a consultant now, one of the big keys is, okay, so where does it make sense to make some change? People don't like to make change, but like you're saying, if that revenue per call is a certain amount and then you're losing so many calls,
right?
Where's that over under on adding more staff, getting more support, bringing in training, bringing in help and being more effective?
That's exactly right. And you know, you can bring that right down to mathematics, and you should. I mean, this is an important thing on a management level to do, so that you can get better and better at it and make sure that you're getting as much revenue for your organization as you can. One of the things that I would add here, obviously this is very important in the private sector, but if you're working for the DMV or you're working for the Secretary of State's office in most states, those are a couple of agencies that actually make revenue for the state. And you should be concerned about things as well. This may be opening some eyes, right? Because people don't think about this, but think about it. Those bring in revenue, and you want to make sure that you're doing everything possible to give really good service so that you'll also bring in revenue to whatever your entity is. And the same thing is true oftentimes for nonprofits. They need to think about this as well so that they are able to make sure that people who are donating, who are supporters, will in fact continue to support and be loyal to them.
And I would say that's truly eye-opening. I've never thought about that before, but you're 100% correct. The DMV is a massive revenue-generating machine. Now, on the flip side of that is people don't have a choice. If they need to get a new driver's license, if they need to get something done, they have to go to the DMV. Yeah. But everyone universally disliked going to the DMV because of the experience they have. Yeah. And so imagine if you're a revenue generator and your experience was different. Imagine if everyone said, I can't wait to go to the DMV because it's such a great experience. Like, right. This is going to be so easy. I lived in Washington State for a while and DMV is different there. So there's licensing is separate from like automobile side, and they're run, one is by the government, one's private, outsourced, kind of contracted. Great experience. I haven't waited in line more than 2 minutes. Everyone is pleasant and nice. It's run completely different. And again, it's a revenue generator. So why not? And right. Then what's fascinating to extrapolate that to companies who they have sales that, yes, it's generating revenue, but they treat it different and their organization is run more from the back end than the front end. What's that sales experience like and what are they supporting on the sales side?
I think that's right. And I just came into my head that there was one center I went to, and they basically sold telephone time to people who had relatives and friends who were in prison. And so the only way that those people in prison could get telephone time was if somebody put money into their account, and they had to call this one call center to do that. Now, this is sort of the absolute max as far as a monopoly is concerned, right? You have no choice. On the other hand, I was able to convince them that they really should get more people, because there are going to be some people who, after an hour of hold time, which they had in some cases, all right, are going to hang up and they're not going to come back. Okay. They're just going to say, you know, what can I do to help out? Or if they do, they're going to come back a lot later and it's not going to make them as much money. So in fact, right, they needed to have better staffing so that they could make more sales, which in this case is really just order taking and taking down credit card numbers. But yeah, I think these things are important to think about in terms of your own organization. How is it that you can optimize your metrics and your performance so that you really get the best for your organization and for yourself, particularly if you're incentivized?
So let's talk about the flip side of that initial question, which is sales specific, because obviously you're dealing in metrics all over the place. What is the advice and or what is the big red flag or something in that realm of where you see an indicator where somebody, their call center sales team is not going well, and either that one metric or few metrics and or advice?
Okay. Well, actually, interestingly enough, the biggest one is turnover. Turnover in sales centers can be a huge problem, and it's one that is an indicator of other dysfunctions and dissatisfactions within the center. And a lot of that has to do, in many cases, with just not having things set up properly and not having acculturated people properly when they come in and not making them feel professional enough, not making them feel appreciated enough. So I'm sure, Jason, you've had situations or you've seen situations where there's high turnover in a center. It is really the canary in the mine. And so it's a different kind of performance metric, but it's one that you should definitely look at because it does have a cost. I would ask anybody who's listening to this to ask themselves, do you know what the cost of turnover is for your sales center or for your inbound customer service center? And if you don't know that, you should know it. Bring out all the components, what it costs to recruit, to vet people, to onboard them, to train them, all of those things. Think about the cost of all that and make sure you're fully loaded. And then say, okay, if I lose somebody right after training, or I lose somebody 3 months or 9 months into things, how much is that costing me? And I should then say, what is it that I could do in terms of raising morale? Gamification, for example, in terms of a whole slew of things, so that that comes down. Part of it may come all the way back to who is it that you're getting into those seats. Maybe it's the wrong people. Maybe you have the wrong approach to your screening and your hiring. You don't want to take on people who you're setting up for failure. And Jason, this is something that unfortunately happens all the time in sales centers, as well as in customer service centers. So everybody talks about the customer experience. You mentioned that when we were talking, right? And the customer journey and the customer experience is so important. Well, happy agents make for happy customers, right? As managers, we need to understand the agent experience from A to Z, the agent life cycle, and really do something about that. Because if we get the right people in, we onboard them the right way, we incentivize them the right way, we coach and mentor them the right way, and we have the right kinds of incentives for them, then it turns into a thing of beauty. I mean, at that point, you really have something that's hitting on all cylinders.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's something I deal with constantly with clients and or in conversations. And yeah, I agree. That's probably the single most important metric for many reasons, right? That turnover rate. And if it's happening within the first 3 to 6 months, a high rate of turnover, then that's on the company. The company is making a decision somewhere in the process that's not working. The recruiting, the onboarding, the training, the managing, the mentoring, the coaching, all of that, something isn't working from the organization side because they're missing something or doing something incorrectly. After a certain point, it becomes that agent, that salesperson, and whether they want to perform or not.
Right.
And I love what you said about that. And the other thing that's interesting and also helps support the case for fixing that turnover issue on the sales side, which is a very clear metric which is nice on the sales side. I have the advantage as a sales coach and consultant, I have a lot of data that can argue for why organizations need to change something, is not just that turnover, the cost of the training, the recruiting, all of those costs, like you said, fully loaded, but then also if that agent in the first 3 months takes 100 leads, 200 leads, and closes subpar, if you had given those leads or calls to a performing agent, how many more sales and how much more revenue would you have created? And that's very easy to calculate, right? They're closing 10%. Yep. They should have been closing 20. We missed 10%. We lost 50K, 100K, whatever that is. Oh my gosh, times X number of agents. Right. Super easy. Not even just making up, oh, let's extrapolate at what they could have done and what they should have done in the next 2 years. No, no, no. Just hard numbers. Like, here's what's costing you.
Right. Important stuff to do. What you're talking about really is the essence of good management. And the thing is, a lot of people in call centers find themselves so inundated with the day-to-day, they don't have the time or the inclination to do the analysis that really is going to make their operation so much better. You need to take that time. You absolutely need to do it.
And I'll tell you, that's been one of the experiences I've had in organizations where the analogy, we're driving down the road and the tire's gone flat and we need to fix it, but we can't stop and pull over because we got to keep going. So how do you change a tire on a car while it's driving 60 miles an hour down the freeway? And so when you're in an organization, you can't. And I've been in that situation where short of stopping the car, you can't. As a consultant coming in, I have the advantage of not being trapped in the day-to-day and being able to do some of that, which is nice. And funny side note for anyone listening or watching this, there's actually videos of people who will do that. They'll drive down the road, turn the car on two wheels while going down the freeway, and a group of people will come out of the side of the car and change the flat tire and then jump back in the car, and then they'll level it out and keep going. So it is possible. It is very possible to change a car while driving down the freeway. So you're focused on the contact centers, the whole organization thing. Obviously, you've been at this game for a very long time. I'm just going to keep hammering on it until it changes in the industry. But is this whole siloed lack of communication, fiefdom, everyone's got their thing, and it's sometimes it's us against the other. Sometimes it's not as outwardly aggressive. Sometimes it's just passive. It's just a lack of communication. What do you see as the solution to that? No matter how many times I bring it up on the show, I think that's so important because that's also an indicator of a healthy organization when those things don't exist.
Yeah, I think the important thing is for people at the top to really be convinced that what you're talking about is important. And when they are convinced that it's important, then they will bring it into their planning and they'll bring it into the way they talk about other parts of the organization and the way they communicate to other parts of the organization. I have something that I call building a radial organization. So the contact center is oftentimes at the center of a hub that involves a lot of other moving parts. And those moving parts will include the product side, because actually the contact centers get to learn a lot about the products, whether they want to or not. I mean, in some cases, they're tech support areas, so of course they need to know. But otherwise, they can be, again, the canary in the mine, to tell the product side that something is really going wrong because they're getting a spike in calls for a new product that's having a problem. And so if that's all kept within their silo, then that's a bad thing. If it's shared the proper way with the others, then that's a really good thing. And the same thing with marketing, for instance. There was a book that was written that we published at a certain point. It's called Marketing Sucks and So Does Sales. And it's basically written from the contact center point of view, and saying that why don't these folks in marketing talk to us about the initiatives that they're doing, because then we get all these calls. Nobody has talked to us about them, about what's going on, and we look stupid and then we get all the blame when we don't say the right things. So what I say is, look, set up your telephone call. Again, this is a silo buster. Set up your call with your marketing counterparts every Monday or every Friday. It can just be 5 minutes, doesn't have to be long, it can be a cup of coffee if you're in the same building. But that way you sit down and you find out what is going on with them. Even though they should be the ones talking to you, you reach out to them and make them your best friends and find out what's going on so that you can then be prepared for what's coming up. And then share that with the workforce management side so that they are staffed up for it. And do that with every part of the organization, every silo that can have an impact on you. There's a big sort of tendency to complain about others rather than to engage with others. So if you say to yourself, part of the fun of being a manager is learning about other parts of the organization and learning how to collaborate with them and be a team player, then you have a whole different attitude toward it. And what you're talking about, Jason, which is so important, is reaching outside the silos. All of a sudden, that becomes something that's a good thing. Bring that to your people as well, if you're a manager, and talk to your supervisors and your agents about that, if you're a contact center manager, then all of a sudden you're becoming not just somebody who's helping to bust silos, you're actually becoming an agent of cultural change. When you get to that level, then wow, it's really exciting. You're doing great stuff. You're making an incredible contribution.
I want to get to the book here in a minute because I think it's amazing. And I just pulled it up while we're chatting. Something I hadn't thought about, and I've been doing this for a while, right? And on this train of busting these silos. And anybody who knows me or my past, I have always been in charge of at least two departments, sometimes more. There's been times where I've been in charge of sales, marketing, and operations, literally everybody. And for me, I think the customer journey, it's one customer through every department. It's right. Not marketing's customer and then sales's customer and the customer services customer and processing or fulfillment. It's one person. They don't care about your departments or your title. They care about getting whatever it is that they want to buy. And the organization needs it to feel that way. And so I've been doing this a long time. And in what you said, it sparked something I hadn't really thought about, which is as a manager being excited about learning about other things, it's, I would say, two of the traits, one of the traits specifically and one action step that I wrote about in my book and I preach to everyone is what it takes to be successful in sales. The number one thing is curiosity, because when I hear you talking, what jumped to mind instantly was being curious about other departments, right? Sales being curious about what does the product team do? What is customer service facing? Like what is going on? And coming at it from a place of curiosity to learn more, and then what do you do with that? And then the second piece of that magical puzzle is empathy, which is understanding that other manager is a human, and it's not me versus them. They have their own problems. They have their own challenges. They got their own department. And then how can we all work together? Because I want to help you win. I want to win. I want the company to win. And I'm curious. I love how you put that in and tie that in for managers to break those silos themselves.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that we've done with our agent course is to try to bring across the need for empathy to agents. So they need to do a lot of things right. But one of the things they also need to do, particularly this was in the supplement for the COVID crisis, was give your managers some slack. They're people too. They're going through a really tough time right now. Have the empathy, as you put it, that will really help out. And it will make you feel like you're more human too when you do that and make you feel part of the team.
If there's one thing I know, it's that sales is full of failure. Even if you're a Hall of Fame level sales professional, you can make a great income despite losing more than you're winning. If there's one aspect of sales that most people fear and what keeps a lot of people even wanting to get into sales, it's getting hit with objections. That is why I wrote my latest book, The Sales Consultant Guide to Overcoming Objections, Yours and Theirs. This is the first in my new series of short books, guides filled with what you need for helping you improve your selling effectiveness. No fluff, no long-winded stories, no filler to make it seem more valuable, just actual foundation-building strategies to help you become aware of the true nature of why your prospects bring up objections, the different type of objections, and then specific ways to overcome them that are universal to most any sales process, product, service, or style. Go to Amazon.com today and get your copy of A Sales Consultant's Guide to Overcoming Objections. Or if you'd rather, as a gift to the listeners of this podcast, email me at jason@cutterconsultinggroup.com and I'll send you a complimentary full version of it as my thank you for listening and supporting this show. And that's what's been interesting about this pandemic is a lot of times there's an issue or problem that comes up either specifically in someone's life or one region of the world, and it's very specific. And it's tough for people to care or relate, right? Okay, you're going through a hurricane, whatever. It's not affecting me, so I just don't care, right? That's our kind of human. We're animals at the primal level in our brain, and that's what kicks in at times, right? Oh, you're going through cancer. I feel bad for you, but I'm not, so it's tough for me to relate. This has been affecting everybody. So everyone's kind of in the same boat together. And I think it's important because it's helped people realize like, just look at everybody as going through something in life and try not to take it so personal in the service. They don't respond fast enough, or they don't say hi to you in the hallway. Maybe it's not you. Maybe it's them. Maybe it's their life. And when you do that, then it helps bust these silos and these relationships in a different way too. So let me talk about the book, because you mentioned it and you hadn't mentioned to me before. So this is kind of a surprise. So Marketing Sucks and Sales Too, that was written in 2004 and I absolutely love it. It reminds me of a presentation that my friend Daryl Prale did about holding sales reps accountable. And it was at a marketing conference. So it was a very full session because he was speaking their language. That was written in 2004. Anything that still applies in there, or any updates you would make to that, that you guys have learned? Anything that jumps out?
Yeah, I think mainly the silo busting. Really, it still is a hard thing for people to do. And so I just say, have you done it as well as you could? And what is it that, get that curiosity that you were talking about, Jason, that's so important to all this. And actually, what I'd like to do is move to the theme of your book, which is authentic persuasion. Can I just talk about that theme and how I've sort of done a little take on?
Let's do it. That was going to be my next question or next topic. So go for it.
Because when you asked me to join you on the show, thank you again for doing that. I was thinking, what kinds of persuasion do I find important and do I think a lot of people find important? And I came up with three kinds of persuasion. And one is data-based persuasion, which is really to help find and frame issues using data, okay? Very important for those of us who are data-oriented, analytically oriented. And the second actually comes out of that, which is research-based persuasion, which adds the academic rigor and analysis to the mere numbers, if you will. And so if you're a person in the sales field and you can actually use in your discussions with your customers data-based persuasion that is then backed by research persuasion, then that's really, really powerful. And then the third thing is the story-based persuasion. And really the story explains the solution, right, to whatever the problem is that's been uncovered by the data and the analysis through someone else's experience. And that's what makes it personal and human. It makes it emotional. And at that point, I think you've got a trifecta of persuasion components that can really help you out. And this sort of approach tells the customer they have to do something for quality or economic reasons. It's in your company's best interest to take action. That is to say, the customer's company's best interest to take action to improve the situation. It's a corporate imperative. For private sector companies, it's like, okay, Mr. Customer, you're basically disrespecting shareholder value if you don't do this, right?
Right.
Why? Because I'm not just telling you that this feature is really cool. I'm telling you that there is data that says it's going to save you money. It's going to make you better. It's going to make you more competitive. On the other hand, in addition to being pushed to do it by these cold, hard facts, right, and the analysis that comes out of it, the story-based persuasion that comes with it, it makes you want to do it on an emotional level. And so I think if the listeners think about arming themselves with these components, it could be perhaps really helpful. If you'd like, I can give you a couple examples from my company.
Yeah, please. You hit us with some data and some facts. So let's talk about the story side now. Go for it.
Okay, good. Well, we deal with customer contacts, call centers all the time. We do have a very large database. And so we're able to talk about things like average speed of answer, average talk time, first contact resolution. That's really an important one. Corresponds very heavily to customer satisfaction and employee turnover, et cetera. And if you give me the metrics from your systems, we can provide you with a report that shows you how you're doing compared with others in your industry. And there it is, black on white. Let's say, for example, if your average cost per call is $5, and your industry average is $3, and you have a budget of $1 million, we can do the math and know your cost structure is putting you hundreds of thousands of dollars behind your competitive peers. And we can look into things and find that while your industry, for example, may have an average of 60% of calls handled by IVR self-service or virtual agents, you only have 35%. Well, why is that? The data is clearly pointing toward persuading you that you need to come up to up your game on the IVR self-service side. So if you're selling the IVR product, and you have armed yourself with this information and you're talking to a call center manager, use this in any situation, but I'm just using it kind that I see. It's very powerful stuff, really powerful. And if you're a provider of self-service systems, knowing this can give you the database persuasion you need to overcome objections and have smooth sailing on your sale. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, Jason, who wants to be behind the competition and have higher costs? I mean, you don't want to be there. And to add to this story, get a testimonial about somebody who got the new system, increased their IVR self-service adoption, kept customer satisfaction high or even increased it, and you have a story with the emotional substance to make the new system very persuasive. And that's the kind of situation, too, where if you add on, and oh, by the way, the guy got a promotion or the woman got a promotion, and that happens. I mean, we see that all the time. Mm-hmm. So employee turnover, talked about that earlier. If your industry average is 15%, yours is 30%, you're losing a lot of money after you do the type of analysis that I was talking about earlier. And we know where to look for the soft spots that are resulting in poor performance. It brings you to the analytical phase, which benefits from experience, et cetera. And then all of this wrapped in a story about how you have revamped your agent processes and your employee processes, and your agent satisfaction has increased from X to Y as a result of all this. You've completed the circle. You've got problem. You've got analysis. You've got the solution. You've got story. And then you're able to put the cherry on top with another piece of data. So it's really nice that way. And if you can arm yourself with this information in whatever your context is, I think it's very powerful.
I love it. And obviously, when you put the persuasion on the end, then you know I'm all aboard on that. And I think what's really great to recap those three that you said was there's the data-based persuasion, the research-based persuasion, and the story-based persuasion. And for me, especially the first two, that helps confront what most buyers and potential buyers are worried about, which is you selling them stuff they don't need or won't help them, which falls in line with pretty much what everyone dislikes, which is dealing with salespeople, because they're afraid that your motivations as a seller is your own motivation and has nothing to do with their benefit or success. And when you have the data, especially when you can use their data to show them that they have that problem, it's not me. And I've done that for years with people. I'll even have them write down the numbers, like grab a piece of paper and write these numbers down because here's what you shared with me. Like it's their data and then they're convincing themselves that they finally need to take action about a problem that they have. They may or may not know. That's what it's all about. It's helping them make that journey on their side. And the data and the research-based really helps from my experience because, again, it's not some guy who might be motivated selfishly trying to convince you it's different. And then the story always helps because no one wants to try something that no one else has done. Very few people want to try. Very few people want to be the first one that tried bungee jumping when that wasn't a thing. Some people will. Some people are crazy and they like taking those risks. Most people, they don't want to be the first one to try bungee jumping on the planet. And so you need to help them realize other people have done it. They survived. They thrived. It's okay. And mm-hmm. Here's what it could feel like for you. Right. So I love it. So let me ask you one of the other topics that you had mentioned too, and this might be the framework you kind of rebuilt into this persuasion trifecta, which I love, is you talked about 360 degree selling. Is that, you know, in the kind of the old verbiage you used to use and now you can put it in this framework, or is that something different?
They're related. So yeah, I mean, really it's making sure that you are walking in the other person's shoes, you really know your product, you really know your market, you really know your arguments, you really know the objections that are going to come up as a result of experience or talking to others, et cetera. And you are really professional at the end of the day. And it's extremely satisfying to have that 360 degree mastery of what you're doing and how you're doing it. It takes time to get there, but that's part of the fun, right? I mean, we all could do it perfectly. We'd be bored. You want to be working toward 360 degree selling so that your features, you can sell to your benefits, but you can also sell to the emotional side of the sale. And you can do it authentically in that you're not trying to push anything on anyone. And the biggest way you know that is if you don't have people with buyer's regret. In other words, you are able to overcome objections, and the kind of objections that really shouldn't be there, but that normal human beings have anyway, right? And so there are a lot of those. There's a lot of those objections that really are not, I don't want to say they're not valid, but in many cases, they're not really that valid. They're just hesitancies that you should be able to confront and make people feel at ease with the decision that they have to make. And again, not try to pull anything over on them, but just try to smooth the way conceptually so that they conceptually can see themselves moving toward a decision that they will be happy with.
Is there any single or dual trait, personality type, action step of top sales agents that you've seen? Anything that jumps out?
We did do a study. It wasn't really in depth, but probably 20 years ago, to try to figure out what the overlap was between people who are really good at customer service and people who are really good at sales. And the overlap was only about 15 to 20%. Okay. And that's why I said toward the beginning, it's important to make sure that you are screening for the right people and not screening for people who you're setting up for failure. You really don't want to do that. It's not nice for anybody. On the other hand, there are situations where people have legacy customer contact centers, and then they have to start doing upselling and cross-selling. It becomes part of their mandate. How do you do that? How do you take somebody who's on the customer service side and turn them into a good salesperson? What you have to do is to be cognizant of the things that motivate them. And what that motivates them is feeling that they're giving really good service to their customers. And so if you can convince them that whatever it is that they are cross-selling or upselling to their customers is in fact something that is going to improve their lives and they're going to do better by, then you've got the hook that you need. And those people, in fact, can turn into really good salespeople. We had one situation with a sort of a holistic health center. And some of the people there didn't like selling at all until one of my colleagues, who's really good at this stuff, went down there, talked to them one-on-one, because he listened to the calls. He said, you realize that that person really needed what this center has to offer. And they said, yeah, they really needed it. And he said, but you didn't represent yourself and your cause, your pitch, if you will, in a way that would make them understand that. And he was able to bring out in them the latent salesperson by letting them understand that, in fact, this cross-selling and upselling isn't going to be for everybody, but for certain of their customers is really going to be a service to them and something that is going to benefit everybody.
I love that. I couldn't agree more. And for me, what I see is that order taker person, whether they're in customer service or they're in sales, various factors, and I won't get into them, but they're acting like an order taker and they could be and or should be in their role acting like something else, doing more persuasion, more sales. And it's never like a permanent label. It's just a current state of the results, which is they're just basically taking orders. And the one thing that I have done as the universal way to shift that is help people realize that it's their duty and responsibility to help someone buy that is qualified, that could benefit from whatever it is that you're selling. Doesn't matter what it is. It could be a couch. I don't care. Like if they need that, it would benefit them. And you know that you have the right solution at the right price for them and it's valuable to them, then you owe it to them. And if they walk away without buying from you, you've actually failed them and let them down. And a lot of times people think about that, and, well, that feels pushy. No, like if you had a friend who had a problem and you knew like, okay, I can't let you keep making this mistake. I got to intervene. What is that feeling? Same reason, right? You go to a good movie or you go to a good restaurant. You're like, I have to tell people and they have to go because they need to experience what I experience. You're doing that because you care about them and you want the best for them. That's why you're doing that. That's why you're persuading. And so I love your example from the customer service side, the upsell, the cross sell, which is I'm helping you because I care. That's why I'm doing it.
Yeah. To add to that, there are stories that can come out of that too. I mean, stories where you can talk about somebody who really benefited from that upsell, that cross sell, and that becomes part of what you're able to offer in terms of persuasion.
I love it. So speaking of which, pivot just a little bit. I mean, we've kind of touched on it. What does it mean to you to be authentic?
I think being authentic is being able to look inside yourself and say, okay, I'm doing something and representing something in a way that I'm proud of. And it's hard sometimes to know if you're an agent who's just learning how to do something about that. And so it's important to have mentors who are able to fill the gap there and make people feel comfortable with it. But at the end of the day, you want to look in the mirror and feel comfortable with yourself and feel that you have, in fact, done a good deed daily instead of bad deeds daily. That's the old scout in me.
There you go. Leave it or the world better off than you found it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, this is the great thing about capitalism, the way it's practiced properly, whether it's capitalism or whether it's what's going on in the government sector or the nonprofit sector. It's people interacting in a way that actually advances everybody's interests and ultimately makes for a better world.
I love it. What do you think when you hear the word persuasion? Obviously, we talked about your kind of trifecta for persuasion, but what does that mean to you, persuasion in itself?
I think of life as a journey, and I'm also thinking things through as a journey. In other words, it's something that I'm not one of these people who sort of starts with a position that's based on where I started. And so persuasion is, you can persuade yourself, you can persuade other people. It's a journey, and it's an intellectual journey, and it should be a stimulating journey. So I see persuasion as, if you're persuading someone else, okay, you're taking them through that journey. And if you're going to do that, then you should be as conscious as possible of where they are and where they're starting and how to get them through that. And actually, this colleague of mine really is good at figuring out how personality type and communication style can be so important to that journey. Maybe I'm going beyond what your question was asking, but I think of persuasion as trying to do that journey, being conscious of the person you have in front of you that you're trying to persuade and trying to figure out where they're coming from and what the best way is for them and for you to communicate so that the communication is in fact persuasion and not something that is results in a brick wall.
The one part I love the most in that, which isn't touched on in the way you said it, which is great, is being cognizant of where the prospect, where the other person, whoever it is that you're trying to persuade, where they're starting at. I see a lot of people, both in sales and in life in general, when they're trying to persuade somebody, they just assume they know where everyone's starting. They assume they know what everyone wants, what their destination is. I see that all the time where people are like, you need to go to this restaurant, check it out. It's like, I do? Like, how do you know what kind of restaurant I like, what kind of food I like? They just assume everybody should want it instead of taking into account the other person. That's why when people ask me for book recommendations, like, what book should I be reading? It's like, I don't know. Like, where are you at? What do you like to read? What do you feel is missing? Let me understand you, where you're at, and then I can make some recommendations. So I love that piece there, that obviously the empathetic side, right? So making it about them, where they're at. And the next question is totally different from this. What did you want to be when you were a kid, when you were growing up? I'm going to guess not a benchmarking contact center master.
No, that's
just
true.
A guess.
That's absolutely true. And actually, if you go back to third grade, I wanted to go into real estate. No, so I actually wanted to be a fireman, then go into real estate, and then really enjoy retirement. And I didn't do real estate, didn't become a fireman, and I have no intention of retiring. So basically, third grade did not predict anything about me. But I've always been interested in business. I'd be interested in politics, too. Today is kind of a weird time for that, so but I didn't go in that direction. But also international business is something that I have been involved in and have really enjoyed.
It's interesting, and I'm just picturing third grade Bruce, so 7-8-year-old Bruce, wanting to get into real estate so that he can retire early.
Yeah, well, my dad was in real estate, so that
got
was, it. Yeah, and fireman, I mean, every third grader wants to.
Yeah. So fireman or policeman, one of those buckets, everyone goes through that phase for sure.
And there have been along the way also just do things in the nonprofit and the volunteer sector. I grew up in New England and sort of volunteerism came to second nature. So I've always been involved in volunteerism. And that's part of the journey of life, too. And it's really one of the very exciting and satisfying parts.
Next question. What does success mean to you? Or how do you define success?
Well, success is, again, I think, feeling that you're able to be creative in contributing. So creativity and contributing, I think, is a big part of success. And making a difference in other people's lives as a result. I mean, this morning I was on with people in South Africa who are trying to build up their BPO, their business process outsourcing. And they have real issues in terms of unemployment there, et cetera. So we're trying to make an extra effort to be useful to them in terms of training and some other things. So if that can work, then I will feel that that was a success. So we'll see. Everything takes time and takes effort, but that's what makes it fun.
I love it. And this is the last question I ask everybody. You kind of touched on it. I don't know which way you might answer this because you have that awesome analytical side and you could go either way. The journey or the destination?
The journey.
Yeah.
There's part of the destination that you kind of take with you. Is that kind of a weird concept? But, and that is family, I'd say. So if I'm able to sort of take this journey, but I've got family there, the family is there. I'm not moving toward the family. The family is there. So having that there and then having the journey be something that's going alongside it, I mean, Jason, I haven't thought about some of these things before. You're going to get me on a couch and you're going to psychoanalyze me. But,
I love it.
But yeah, I would say that the destination is really a lot having to do with sort of personal things. The journey has to do with both personal and professional.
I love it. Bruce, I appreciate it for everyone listening or watching this. Bruce Belfiore. So a couple of things here. Benchmarkportal.com, which is the company we've been talking about with all your data. For anyone in the contact center space with any kind of contact center, benchmarkportal.com is the place to go to see the research, to get the help on that side. I mean, I think all this stuff is amazing and to help unlock that data-driven side. And this isn't a paid product promotion. I just know that contact centers always need more data and insight what others are doing and make those shifts. So I just love it. That's why I wanted you to be on here. And then your monthly show, Call Talk. Obviously, there's a long link to get there, but if they look on the Benchmark Portal site, or look up Call Talk, you can find it there, online radio. And then the other thing I mentioned in the very beginning, but for people to find, they can also find it through the benchmarkportal.com site, is your College of Call Center Excellence, which we didn't really talk about, but you told me offline that obviously you're doing a lot of online, a lot of virtual training. It's very impactful, especially work from home, especially COVID pandemic, helping people with those transitions. A lot of cool certification programs for contact centers and agents to use. So Bruce, thanks again for being on the Authentic Persuasion Show. Let me throw some curveballs at you and sharing what you know from all the research you guys have done. So thank you for being
here. And I'll just recommend Dr. Jason Cutter. He will get to the bottom of whatever it is you are, and he'll help you out. So,
well, and I've said that for years. A good salesperson ends up being a good therapist because they're helping their prospects with much deeper things than just whatever they're addressing. So yeah, it's funny and it's true. It does end up being that way sometimes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the Authentic Persuasion Show. If you found value in this episode, please do two things. Subscribe so you can get each new episode and share this episode with anyone else you know in sales. Together, we can help shift the way sales is done. And if you want to find out more information about how to transform your sales career, or you want help with shifting your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, go to jasoncutter.com. Don't forget that everything in life is sales, and I will catch you on the next episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show.